What is up, everybody? This is Dr. Joe Armstrong. Today, we are updating a lot of things. It's been a little bit since we checked in on the influenza issue in dairy cattle. Right out of the gate, the thing that we need to talk about first is what we're calling this thing for now. In previous episodes, we have talked about this as HPAI in cattle, or you may have heard me refer to this as HPAI-like virus in cattle. And it's time to be done with those names. So why is it time to be done with those names? Well, there's a couple different reasons. One, when we say HPAI, we're referring to highly pathogenic avian influenza. There is really only one of those things that applies to this situation anymore, and that is influenza. In cattle, this virus is not highly pathogenic, and cattle are not avian. So while this virus might have avian origins, if it is truly circulating in cattle and it is being passed between cows, which USDA has not officially said that is true yet, but I find it incredibly unlikely that it is not passing from cow to cow, the virus may have started in a bird, but it is now circulating in the bovine species. Therefore, it is a bovine virus. So all of that adds up to a situation where we should, in my opinion, not be referring to this as HPAI in cattle. Now, we have a couple different options out there, and there is some debate on this currently. One of the suggestions that has been put forward was put out there by AABP, or the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. Their suggestion for what to call this situation and this virus, this disease, is bovine influenza A. To me, that is a great choice. This is a virus that is circulating in bovine species, and it is an influenza A. Simple, bovine influenza A. Now, what is the hesitation for using this term put forward by the predominant bovine veterinary practitioners group in the United States that has been involved in this process from the very beginning? Why would we hesitate to take their lead? That piece is not 100% clear. But when we put a name to something, we are admitting that it's a problem, and we're admitting that, in general, the virus is causing the disease. We're also admitting that this problem isn't going away. All of that combined is working against people taking the lead of AABP and referring to this as bovine influenza A. USDA has yet to confirm that the virus being found is causing the clinical syndrome. There is so much reluctance to make that connection from USDA. But it's not just USDA that has the reluctance to make that connection. There is a tendency to bury our head in the sand when we have something potentially overwhelming to deal with. And we can't afford to do that. We can't bury our head in the sand on this as an industry and ignore it. This may be not a big deal, burn itself out, be done, but it may not. And if we are only preparing ourselves for it burning itself out and not being a big deal, then we're not doing ourselves or the industry justice by not preparing for what could happen. And then essentially we're caught with our pants down if it does. So at this time, I will be referring to everything that's going on as bovine influenza A or H5N1 in cattle. Both are accurate. Many pieces of the industry will likely refer to it in something like H5N1 in cattle or influenza A in cattle, something like that, without actually naming the problem. For now, that's okay. They are accurate terms that refer to the problem in some way without calling it something that it's not. So we'll take baby steps for now. Okay, what else are we going to do today? Well, we got to get an update on what's going on. Where is the virus? Right now, officially confirmed, we have Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, Idaho, Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, and South Dakota. As of today, there are no more confirmed human cases. CDC has not told us about any other human cases. Now, to reiterate, that does not mean that there have not been more cases. It means there have been no more reported cases. Again, just a reminder of who the most likely population to be in direct contact with cattle is. Oftentimes, those are people that have moved from another country, may not speak English as their first language, and may or may not feel comfortable coming forward or seeking medical help. So do I think there are other human cases of H5N1 in cattle going to people and causing people to get sick? Yes, absolutely. I do think there have been more human cases, but there have not been any official human cases that have been reported. Now it's time to reiterate our message from FDA. There is no concern for the commercial milk supply or the meat supply. So people that are at risk for getting this virus are in direct contact with cattle. The rest of this episode is really to help people prepare and get ready for what happens if this illness comes to your farm. What to expect, how much work you're going to have to do, potential treatment options for cattle that become sick, what it looks like generally on your farm, and other things you need to be thinking about. In this process, I've been very lucky to be able to talk to a lot of people that have had experience dealing with this on farm. And one of the biggest things when I talk to farmers about this issue and the farms that have already experienced this is that they're very concerned about making sure that the information they have is shared and that people can learn faster than they did by taking their advice and being a little more prepared and knowing what to look for. It's been very adamant from the farmers that I've talked to that I share the information they're sharing with me so that everyone can be ready and they don't have to learn the hard way. So initially, we were getting reports that this illness was in mid to late lactation cows, second lactation and older. And initially, we were told that is the group impacted. No other groups are really affected. Talking with these farmers, looking at records, I don't believe that is true. When we look at something like this hitting a dairy and everyone being exposed, the way this is acting is that pretty much everyone gets the virus. And then we experience a range of clinical signs, all the way from completely asymptomatic to severely affected, not eating, not producing milk, depressed, lethargic, fever, the whole works. Now, a reminder, cattle are not dying. This doesn't seem to be a highly pathogenic virus. That's why we're not calling it highly pathogenic anymore. But we are seeing evidence of other groups being impacted, not just this mid-lactation animal that's second lactation and greater. Now, there still appears to be a couple groups that are spared most clinical signs and issues, that being calves and dry cows. One of the very first things that's noticed when this comes through a dairy is a drop in feed intake. So measuring feed intake is a super valuable thing to have. It's not always possible on every dairy to have a quantitative measure of feed intake. Not everyone weighs back refusals and sees what intakes are. But in some way, we should be calling bunks and we should have an idea of where cattle are for intakes. So the first thing that farms are seeing is a decrease in feed intake. This is one of the ways that I can tell that it's not just second lactation and greater animals that are impacted. Because when I look at feed records and feed intake data, I can see that the drop also happens on some of these dairies in lactation 1 animals. So whether or not they're noticed as being as clinically impacted with the whole gambit of clinical signs doesn't mean they're not impacted in some way. We are seeing a reduction in feed intake in those animals, so something's going on. All of that is to say that we need to be watching all the animals on our farm for clinical signs. Now, what are those clinical signs? Like I said, a decreased feed intake, which relates to a decrease in milk production, fever, lethargy. Initially, it was reported that almost all of the cows had dry, tacky manure, We now know that that is not the case. There are some diarrhea cows. There are some cows with dry, tacky manure. So we got to be watching all of our cattle, with the first sign being a drop in feed intake. Now, very interesting. Several of the dairies that I talked to said they saw this drop in feed intake over time for about 10 days. It went from normal to as low as it was going to get 10 days later after the initial drop. When these dairies had no idea what was going on and they didn't know what to look for, they weren't super aggressive about pulling cattle. And they didn't see an overtly clinical animal until that 8, 9, 10 day mark. But now that dairies know what to look for and they've been looking for those things, they're pulling cattle much earlier in this process and getting them help faster, which becomes a huge piece of this. Early intervention with supportive care is going to be your best friend in this whole game. Now, unfortunately, supportive care, when I say that, related to cattle, is a ton of work. It's not as simple as pulling an animal, giving them a shot, and being done. Most of what we're concerned about is supporting rumen health, hydration, and then some kind of response to this inflammatory process. In general, when we hear cattle are off of feed, depressed, some have fevers, some have diarrhea, some have tacky manure, all of that, especially when we see this huge range, just means that we have inflammation. Now, if we accept that the virus is causing the illness, which USDA has not said yet, we're treating a virus, not a bacteria. So antibiotics may or may not be warranted, but they are for secondary issues and they are not treating the primary problem. The primary problem is treated with supportive care. We need to focus first and foremost on rehydration, rumen health, and then a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication. That is the basis for how you will treat animals once they are pulled. Now, when we look at the feed intake data, we're looking at a 1.5% drop initially, then another 1.5% over the next few days, and then another 1.5% over the next few days. And then all of a sudden, as we get to that 7-8 day mark, we're getting a 5% drop pretty much overnight and another 5% drop in feed intake the next day. Pulls of sick cattle are lagging behind that just a little bit because as intakes decrease, milk production also decreases, but it might not be immediate and at the same time. When we look at hospital pens, as this progresses and we hit that low in feed intake, we're seeing pretty much a bell-shaped curve of pulls. So it starts slow, ramps up, peaks, and then drops off again. Just standard bell-shaped curve of pulls. The total time covering that bell-shaped curve of pulls is anywhere from 14 to 21 days after the initial feed intake drop. So in looking at some of the data I have access to, in talking to a lot of different farmers, the consensus has been that you should be prepared to treat approximately 5% of your total milking herd per day. That is what you should be prepared to do. So if we break that down, a 5,000 cow dairy that's milking 5,000 cows should be prepared to treat 250 animals per day. And then a 500 cow dairy should be prepared to treat 25 animals per day. So I keep saying treatment without telling you specifics. Well, that needs to be done in a team effort with your veterinarian. Developing the protocols for your farm should be done with a veterinarian. In general, like I said, we need to treat hydration and rumen health. Those two can be treated usually with a drench. So for the standard mildly dehydrated cow, that would be 10 gallons of water going into that rumen with likely an additive that includes an energy source. Think about the things that we give fresh cows. Those are good options to put in your drench mix. So cows that are more severely dehydrated, you can go 15 or even 20 gallons of water drenched. There might be some very severe cows that potentially need fluid therapy IV, but we're talking about potentially a massive number of cows that need to be treated. And at some point, we have to decide on the treatment protocol and account for severity in some way, but we can't take all day to do it because there's just so many cows that need attention. So for now, I think we'll leave that up to veterinary discretion about IVing animals, and I'm going to focus on drenching animals with fairly large volumes to solve my hydration problem. So we've got our drench going in to solve hydration, support rumen health, provide potentially a little bit of energy, knowing that these animals are probably in a negative energy balance. After that, an anti-inflammatory medication, I think, is a good idea. Now, in my mind, that needs to be a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. So what are our options on that front? Well, that's definitely one where you got to talk to your veterinarian about which one is going to go in your protocol. One of the big things that we have to consider is our milk withdrawal and our meat withdrawal when we're looking at which drug to use. Now, given that we have a ridiculous number of cattle to treat in some cases, my recommendation, if I was still in practice, would likely be transdermal Bantamine. It is more expensive than other options, but I don't have to IV cattle like I would with an injectable Bantamine, and it only has a 48-hour milk withdrawal and an 8-day meat withdrawal. So I think it is a good compromise between speed, efficacy, price, and having a product that's labeled for cattle. If I was in a situation where we had limited supply of transdermal Bantamine, I would go to a model where we looked at severity of clinical signs using probably our temperature as our factor on whether or not we used transdermal Bantamine or not. If the animal has a fever, they do get transdermal Bantamine. If they do not have a fever, they do not get transdermal Bantamine. That's how I would work it if we were short on supply. Now, that is what to expect, a little bit more of the clinical picture and what we would be treating animals with. How we pull animals is another thing. How we account for all the labor we're going to need is another thing to figure out. Ideally, we would have several people working on pulling animals. There should be someone in the parlor that is in charge of identifying animals that are severely down on milk. However you want to identify them, that they need to be pulled, or maybe you have a sort gate where you can just pull them, that's a good idea. We should also have someone walking pens, looking for cattle that are lethargic, depressed, dehydrated, just off. Someone should be pulling animals that way as well. With limited labor, most of our attention should be paid to the most impacted group, which remains that mid-lactation and later second lactation and greater. But we cannot ignore the rest of the lactating herd. And that brings me to another point where we should be paying attention to the rest of the lactating herd. I told you that lactation one in a couple of the farms where I had a chance to look at records also had a decrease in feed intake. So one of the things that I think about when we talk about feedlot medicine is that we need to pull and treat the animals that are sick. But we also have to figure out how to keep the healthy animals healthy. We got to hit it from two fronts. So in preparation for some of this stuff, or as soon as you notice something might be off, I think it's a good idea to add, after talking to your veterinarian and your nutritionist, make sure you talk to both, add something to the ration in the form of a pre, pro, or postbiotic. The entire herd is about to experience some form of stress. And we know that pre, pro, postbiotic products have the ability to buffer some of that stress on the rumen. Healthy rumen, healthy cow. It's an effort to reduce the impact on the herd overall. That is plenty to think about, but I'm going to leave you with just a few more things to think about before I let you go. We're talking especially with the level of supportive care that we need. We're talking about a lot of work. We're also talking about a lot of contact, direct contact, for some people that are having to do that work with sick cattle. That needs to be taken into account when we think about personal protective equipment, PPE, and explaining to the people doing the work the why behind what we're doing and the risks that they are potentially going to be under while they do their job. We're also talking about repeatedly using some equipment over and over and over again that is going to go in the mouth and down the throat of these cattle. We need to have a plan for how we're going to disinfect that. Even though we're talking about treating sick cattle that are all probably sick with the same thing, adding more viral load to those cattle unintentionally is still not a good idea. So we need to be disinfecting or taking some steps to clean things between animals. So I know there's some gaps in what we talked about today as far as the big picture, what kind of control plan we need in place for this issue. I will say right out of the gate, there should not be any stopped movement interstate. There should be no additional requirements between states related to this issue. When we identify the proper way to control this issue, it will need to be from industry, and it will probably require some movement stoppage within a system and at a premise. Having additional regulations between states does not help the issue. Next time we cover this topic, I will be looking at some frequently asked questions that I get about this topic and trying to answer those. And we'll be looking more at what are some of the possibilities for control when we talk about what we need to do, building off of what our colleagues on the poultry and the swine side do to adapt those plans to cattle. That's enough for today. Thank you everybody for listening. I will catch you next episode. Bye.